My name is Rory Malloy. You're listening to The Dawn of Crime, a podcast that is contributing endless amounts of knowledge to the national database of what it means to be a crook, a thief, a cheat, or come in contact with the law somehow. This podcast is more seriously dedicated to offering biography to people who came and went, or things in general, in Australia's past that touched upon law, order, crime, or punishment. The podcast itself is named after the Dawn of Crime book series, a series which I've published, and they're available online. So jump online and Google the Dawn of Crime, anywhere you can find good books. I am joined today again by my good friend Shane Gordon, stand-up comedian, all-round cricket fanatic, and a personal trainer if you're looking for somebody to train you via Zoom during lockdown. Good morning, Mr. Gordon.
Good afternoon, Roy. The pleasure is all theirs.
I got me on a technicality. I haven't reset my watch.
I'm one of those people.
Daylight savings, I didn't reset my watch. We are talking today about one of my pet topics, and it's maybe surprising that it goes into the law and order and punishment. What do you think of when you think Luna Park?
I think about that roller coaster that I'd never, ever get on, and I'm just waiting to fall down.
In Melbourne?
Yeah.
So how many Luna Parks are you aware of in your world and life?
I only know of the Melbourne and Sydney ones.
You got it. So as it stands presently, we have two in Australia. Mm. We have one in St Kilda in Victoria, and we have one on Sydney Harbour, overlooking the incredible bit of water underneath the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
That's all they've got though, isn't it? That's all they've got is the harbour. They talk about how great it is.
I thought you were going to say all they've got is Luna Park. I was going to say, yep. But, you know. And look, the Sydney Luna Park was, in its own day and its own way, a nesting bed for a pretty famous crook at one point. We may come back to that another time, but we're going right back to the very beginning of this story. And one of the most iconic parts of Luna Park, what would you say the tourist attraction bit of Luna Park is?
Yeah, definitely the big gob that's out the front that you walk through.
Okay, so if you're listening from other countries, jump online and Google Luna Park, Melbourne or Sydney.
We have this, gob means mouth.
Gob. You need to probably get some colloquialisms. But the entrance to the Luna Parks in Australia have been designed so that they look like you're walking into the mouth of a giant, and everything inside his guts is your wonderland. I don't know how else you describe that. How would you describe that experience?
Yeah, I reckon you've nailed it. Yeah, you're just walking through it's not an attractive head either.
And so then we ask the question, whose idea was that? Have you got any ideas? Yourself?
Ooh, no, actually, I hadn't thought about it. Probably someone that designed the big pineapple.
The big prawn. Any number of, we love big things in Queensland, hey? They are not compensating for anything. And I find it sad, and I'm glad for this opportunity. I find it sad that in Australia, we don't really make a fuss of the people that did these kinds of things. You know, in America, for example, they have, you know, the guy who built Mount Rushmore. I can't remember his name. I'm not an American, but you get where I'm going. We don't really tend to name these people, do we? And so in a small part, because there was some crookery and shifty behavior, we get to do so on this podcast. One of the first books I wrote was several years ago. I had back surgery, and because, you know, that I needed to get an upgrade like my iPhone does regularly. And so I got an upgrade, and I had 6 weeks in bed, and I wrote a book called The Dark Side of the Moon. Now, anything about Luna Park, I couldn't have chosen a better title, because a lot of people overlook, you know, because of the lights and the happiness and the, you know, that there was a lot of shiftiness in the early Luna Parks. And one of the first ones that I'm going to talk about is just the blatant theft that went on. What country is Luna Park come from, Shane?
What countries does it come from?
Yeah, where do we? What's the origin of Luna Park?
I just thought it was an Australian amusement park with dodgy rides.
And therein, so Luna Park begins in earnest when I reckon he's one of those bipolar genius guys. In America, with his business partner, they make a ride. Now, you got to understand, there was a certain time when everything we know didn't happen. So, for example, sideshows that, we know, you're walking down an alleyway lined with carnies left and right, there was a time before that was known. And so the first time that happens, it was a big deal. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
And so World's exhibitions were becoming a really big thing. And, you know, you're living in colonial New Zealand or colonial Australia, and we're talking, you know, before Federation, the 1880s. And all of a sudden, a World's exhibition would come to, and in 1888, Melbourne, we have one. And rides were a thing. And they only really more or less happened because the people running the exhibitions, they kind of ran out of people to rent the spaces. So they turned it over to the unwashed, and they ended up with people who would run games and joints. And does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this fella in America, he and his mate, they made a ride called the Trip to the Moon. You'd line up, you'd get inside what looked like a rocket. You'd sit in captain's chairs. And outside the window, they would roll a great big canvas scroll from one end to the other, but it would whiz past you like a scenery moving. And the thing would rock around, and people were vomiting. They were that shocked by the moving scenery on the canvas. When you arrived on the moon, you'd get out, you'd exit the aircraft, and you'd be in an auditorium. There would be a dancing display put on by little people. A lot of these podcasts go to dwarfs. I don't know why, but a lot of them do go to dwarfs. And they would do a dance for you. You get back on the ship and it'd take you back to Earth. And it was so incredibly successful. They built a whole park around this one ride called the Trip to the Moon, and they made Luna Park.
How many little people did they have?
They had a lot of them. I mean, so many. And look, I reckon it's the kind of thing where today, if it happened, Amnesty International would act upon it.
Like, where did they get them all from? Was there a plague?
They were literally rounding them up from every country. They were doing full blown, pull into town, bring out your persons of little stature. Oh, like,
we're going to ship them over. We don't need a big ship. Just
yeah, more or less. And so, you know, this thing became a phenomenon. Now, you're talking, you know, late 1890s in New York, and the original creator was still alive. And then New Zealand said, well, let's get in on a bit of this action too. So 1906 comes around and New Zealand has their own international fair. The thumbnail I'm going to use for this podcast, I am aware that the thumbnails are only visible on Anchor, which is the place where I house. There's a platform where I put these podcasts. Head over to Anchor and you'll see the thumbnail image for this podcast. And I'll also put one on Roy Malloy, author, on today's date. But you're looking for the New Zealand 1906-1907 Wonderland entrance. Now, to all intents and purposes, I've just sent it to Shane. As you're looking at that picture, what are you looking at in the entrance to the 1906-07 Wonderland in Napier, New Zealand?
Yeah, it doesn't look like a happy place at all. It looks quite scary. It looks dark. It looks like something you wouldn't send your children to.
But the entrance itself, what does that reminisce of?
The big mouth, you mean?
Yeah,
it's maybe the Joker.
Doesn't look like the Luna Park mouth from Melbourne?
Oh, yeah, it's less attractive, which is associated with New Zealand.
So we've got, that's where we get our concept for the mouth that you walk through to enter Luna Park. It's blatantly ripped off from New Zealand. And
so they weren't in cahoots?
No, not at all. Not at all related.
Uh-huh.
And so our Luna Park in Melbourne is built 6 years later. So the guy who built Luna Park in Melbourne is a guy called J.D. Williams, and he's a very difficult guy to research. He's born in Canada, picks up with a circus as a sideshow operator, goes through America, goes to England, sees the technology of film, and he becomes a film man. And he pays Charlie Chaplin his first $1 million check. So he's not a small-scale operator. He's a very big-time operator. He has a chain of cinemas in Australia and elsewhere. The most famous one, I guess, is on Bourke Street Mall, opposite where David Jones now is. It was the Melba Theatre. And Williams was, he was aware of things that he'd seen in his life. So he was aware of sideshows, which were brand new, you know, 1890s. He worked with Ringling Brothers, and they had a great big secondary tent that was a, you know, a sideshow tent. He had been to New Zealand. He'd seen Wonderland. And he had been to Coney Island and seen Luna Park. So when he ended up in Australia, he's got a bit of money. He thought, you know what? I'm just going to flat out blatantly rip off all those other people, even down to naming it Luna Park. He had no association with the massive Coney Island Luna Park in New York, but he named ours Luna Park. Now, our Luna Park in Melbourne is, I think, 4.5 acres. Luna Park in Sydney is exactly on 5 acres. How big do you believe New York Luna Park was? Coney Island.
Three.
32.
Ooh-wee.
It was, yeah, sprawling and enormous, right? So what he made in Melbourne really probably was very small and not really worth getting very worked up about in New York.
But yeah, that's right.
The other part of it is it was absolute copyright, you know, breach of copyright. And Luna Park was copywritten as a name and a concept. However, when you had to send all your mail by boat, it took the better part of a month and a bit to get to Australia. So let's say, you know, you own Luna Park and this guy's just flat out ripped you off. You write your first letter and it says, desist or be sued. I reckon he'd go, all right, toss it in the bin.
Yeah, it's easy for that letter to get lost too, isn't it?
Come get me. You know, it would just be so hard to pursue anything internationally. Do you know what I mean? It'd just be such an amazing. Have you ever spent much time overseas?
Just in the sort of Southeast Asian countries, your Balis, your Thailands, your Vietnams.
Yeah. The, anything that's a brand they rip off, they just.
That's right.
And they probably have the same approach as come get me. I've got
What are you going to do? What are you doing? Yeah. What are you going to take off me? My sandals? Go for it.
It was all just a bit too hard, I think. And so, lo and behold, Melbourne then had Luna Park.
The moral of the story, if you're going to rip someone off, just do it small.
Yeah, you do it in Australia. No one's going to – you're doing what down there? Yeah, good luck. All right. And so we've got – then we ended up with Luna Park in Melbourne, 1913. And he thought to himself, you know, this is going pretty good. But remember, this guy's a big-time businessman. He's in his 30s. And he thinks, you know what, I might keep expanding this because it's actually doing pretty well. We only had a population of 5 million at this time, remember. It's a very – everybody lived close to the cities more or less, but we had a small population. So he went to Adelaide with the next Luna Park. If you get a chance, Google Radelaide's Luna Park. It was on Glen Elg Beach, and it wasn't an enclosed space. They already had a collection of vendors down on Glen Elg Beach, and they had, you know, throw the coconut at the cups kind of guy. They had, you know, spin the wheel guy, and they were all leasing space from the Glen Elg Council. So the council said, look, you can bring Luna Park here and rent the rest of the space, but you've got to keep leasing those guys their exact existing spots. So they built Luna Park around about 15 vendors, literally built it around them. It's kind of like that Dr. Seuss book, where the two guys face each other and they end up building highways around them and it, more or less like that.
Yeah, smart.
And so they had this fully functioning Luna Park, but no one in Adelaide wanted to go to it. They all thought it was a little bit lowbrow, wasn't good enough. So the moral of this story is he picked it up and moved it to Sydney. So a lot of the hardware that's in Sydney was once in Adelaide. That makes sense. So he opens
it. Does.
So it ships it all up to Sydney, off he goes, and then you've got the two Luna Parks. Now, this brings us to the focus of this story. Now you've done your back issues. In Melbourne in the 1920s, we had a few attractions. Luna Park was probably chief among them. We had a bunch of very big ballrooms. There was another one. There was a ballroom next to Luna Park called Palais de Danse, And in between it and Luna Park was the Palace or Palais Theatre. So there's your pleasure hub, you know. There's a young bloke on a tram and he's trundling off to work, 1920, and he's on his tram and he's going down just your normal route to work. But this young bloke, his name is Lionel Morris, and he came to Australia as an immigrant with his family from England. And he's really making a fist of this new life. He's by himself in the world. He's 20 years old and he sees a bit of land beside the tram tracks in amongst the houses and the shops in Malvern. Now, Malvern is a middle-class suburb, was then as well. He sees this block of land and it has not been developed. Now, he's working for a real estate agent in Bourke Street. He's doing pretty well for a 20-year-old. And his job is to subdivide and fill out all the compliance and the paperwork to subdivide blocks of land exactly like it. Bit of a boring-ass job, I got to admit. I mean, everything could be by mail correspondence. He's 20 years old. He's sitting in an office every day, filling in paperwork, right? But as he's on this tram ride, he starts daydreaming about how cool it would be if he owned the block of land and he could subdivide it and sell it and make the profit. The only link there is that he doesn't own the block of land, but it didn't stop him selling it.
Nice.
Right. So he starts, I mean, what do you think of when somebody offers you something that they don't have permission to sell?
Yeah, it's a bit of a red flag, you would have thought.
I think Jack and the Beanstalk, you know, if you're going to buy that, here's some magic beans. That's about the sum of
Amway.
Yeah, like some pyramid scheme. And this is not far from it because he starts approaching mates saying, look, I'm subdividing this block. Do you want to buy a share? Very quickly, they start giving him money because he's, you know, he's an impressive guy and he talks well. In the police gazettes after his arrest, just to give you the ending halfway through, they actually say, beware of this guy. He's got an ability to talk so well he can get involved in upper circles of society. Right? He's a very good con man. When he's in court, he's sitting there and the judge says, look, you know, you've been stung for this. What have you got to say? And he's got a woman just behind him sobbing, a young, very good looking girl. And he says, Your Honor, I went away to war. I fought in the 1914-18 war. And I fought in France and I brought this young girl back with me. She doesn't speak English. She's a foreign, an exotic flower in foreign soil. Please let me stay out of jail. Beautiful. Yep, let me stay out of jail. And she's pregnant. Let me make this right, and I'll pay the money back. The judge doesn't have a bar of it. Sends him straight to Pentridge for a year and a half. Turns out he was never married. He paid an actress, and he'd never been to war. Right. So his gifts as a con man are pretty schmick.
He's like Frank Abagnale.
He's pretty good. He's like, I can think of a lot. I mean that's up. That's top level. That's a whole difficulty level up on a video game of conning people, right? To pay someone in court. So he gets out of Pentridge, right? And he leaves the state, goes to Perth. But the things he's seen in Melbourne and then sees in Adelaide on the way through are Luna Parks. So he ends up in Perth and he looks around. Now, Perth has a... Have you been to Perth?
Just popped in. Not for long.
That's probably all more or less needed.
I love... Is it like Shepparton? With a beach?
Yeah, Shepparton with a beach, more or less. I love Perth and I love Perth people. They're stunning, but it's not known for its size, you know. But when he got there, he saw Cottesloe Beach, which is, you know, then the equivalent of St Kilda and Glenelg or Manly, you know, around the country. It's the location. And down there was an existing group of vendors doing the same kinds of things with a knock them down and a spin the wheel. Remembering that games of chance were illegal and punishable and actively punished if you got caught playing them, but the police turned a blind eye on a lot of occasions because it was inconsequential. When he got there, he thought, you know what? I can sell shares to a Luna Park. So it's now not just selling shares to a bit of land he doesn't own. He first goes to the vendors and says, guys, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to unite you and I'm going to go find buyers. They say, no worries, tell us what you need us to do. So then he goes to rich people in society, and I don't know how he gets in touch with them, but he does. And he goes to a doctor, a surgeon, actually. He goes to a lawyer, which was his undoing. And he says, look, give me £500 a piece. And he starts, they start giving him money. He's incredibly clever and astute because he builds an outdoor platform for ballroom style 1920s dancing, jazz dancing, you know. And it's a great big platform that just juts out to sea a bit. So then he organizes the carnies a bit better, adds a few, like, you know, different little knock 'em downs and things like, and food vendors he adds. And it becomes a real funky place to be. It's an outdoor carnival. It's got a dance platform. He gets Australia's version of Count Basie, who's a jazz man, to bring his band, and they play every night. And he starts paying taxi drivers to say, they pick up a fare in Perth. They say, take me here. They says, well, you know, I could. How about I just take you to Cottesloe instead?
And all
the taxi drivers just start dropping people off, and they get a kickback, right? Does the same with the bus companies. Pays them to reroute via him. So people just start pouring in. Now, the mistake he made was that there was already something in place before him. Right in the heart of Perth is the law courts. They're down by the Swan River. Perth kind of gently slopes downhill towards the Swan. And then you've got these beautiful gardens. And next to the gardens is the courts. Where the gardens are now, there used to be a thing called the White City. Historically, there was a place called Luna Park. And then over time, around the world, people would say, oh, there's a fun fair up at the local primary school. Or they would also conversely say, they're putting on a Luna Park at the primary school. It became a word for a fun fair. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
They do the same thing with white cities. There'd been a white city in the US, and then white cities became a thing. Well, they had a semi-permanent white city in Perth. It was a kind of a fenced-off area, like a showgrounds. And every month, a different charity would rent it. And they put on their own exhibitions, and they'd raise their money, and then they'd clear off. The next one would have a turn. But all these charities, you know those long 1920s names for charities? The Women's Auxiliary for Men Affected by all these kinds of... that's who was using the White City Showgrounds. So they started competing a little bit. They put electric lighting in, and then they, you know, tried to add a good Scottish Highland band. But they couldn't compete with jazz and beer on the beach, right? But these auxiliaries were all more or less all run by the wives of politicians and lawyers and businessmen.
Mm.
So Lionel Morris, while he was in the throes of running Luna Park and was throwing attraction after attraction at it and making it bigger. I mean, as far as being an impresario goes, this guy was my hero. The way he was able to make absolute magic out of nothing is just incredible. And there's a lot more detail that I'm kind of overlooking, but he's God level when it comes to this.
And he's only young too.
He is. He's very young. What were you doing at 22?
22, I just got back from a stint overseas, and my dad said to me, you can't keep doing this. Go get a job.
And what do you do now?
I'm a PT now and stand-up comedian. Both pay really well.
You and me both, old boy.
Yeah.
And so he Lionel is really in the newspapers a lot. He's a socialite in Perth, and it's just rubbed everybody the wrong way. So what he does, right, he goes on a Friday afternoon to get the stock that's needed for the weekend of trade. And we're thinking sausages, bottles of Coke, prizes for the joints. He's that guy, right? And he goes to one of the big supermarket kinds of places in Perth. He goes there every week, and he picks up about £200 worth of groceries. That's like, you know, $2,500 to us. It's quite a lot of money. But, you know, in a commercial stock, it's not that big. He's just getting the stock that you'd need for 500 people to come to your venue, right? So he goes and picks it up, and he's got it at the cashier, and she tells him how much it costs, and he writes a check. Now, he's got no money at all in the bank account, but that's not a problem, because what you do is you write a check on Friday, 4 p.m., the banks close at 4. So it's going to be Monday before they can bank it, Tuesday before a clerk looks at it. And if you've got the weekend's takings, you've already banked it and you cover the check. So it's a very, it's a crude line of credit, right? So he gives her the check, but this young lady has already been flagged to see him. And as soon as he gives her the check, she runs to the bank before it closes. They bounce the check. And when he arrives back at Luna Park, the police are waiting for him to say, you've presented a fraudulent check and you're not allowed to trade.
Ooh.
So he turns, So he turns to the showies and he says, guys, we can do this. We can just get through the weekend without any prizes, without any food. We can just keep the income from what we make. And they say, oh, no, no, no. You're completely shut down.
And there's people there.
People there. And they're completely shut down because of the jealousy of others. He ended up having to go to court for the checks that were written. And they put him away in Fremantle Prison. When he came out 18 months later, he was a different guy. And he never went back to being a showman. He ended up heading out to the Pilbara in West Australia, where he wandered around the Pilbara looking for what do they mine out there? The opal, isn't it? So they're looking for opal.
Yeah, opals or
So that was the end of Lionel Morris. Luna Park in West Australia did go on to grander and bigger things, and it took on a whole other life of its own when it removed to Scarborough in the 1930s, a decade later. But that is a nutshell version of the story of the Luna Park that was once in West Australia. Have you learned something today, Mr. Gordon?
I have, yes. I enjoyed that one. That was a good one.
It's a good one, not like the other rubbish.
No, the other ones were trash. This was a ripper.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to The Dawn of Crime. Please make sure you jump online and Google The Dark Side of the Moon, which this book is written about and for. We'd love to have you again another time. Thanks for coming.